I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, LiveSearch, and Ask.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As you know, Philadelphia is a city of neighborhoods, but how much do the residents of Brewery Town or Society Hill know about the residents of Powelton or Strawberry Mansion? One way to find out is to turn to Channel 12 Sunday nights at 11:30 for Precious Places. It's a project of Scribe Video Center. Residents were given cameras to provide oral and video portraits of their communities, and taken together, they offer a rich picture of the ethnic, political, and cultural diversity of the city, as well as Camden across the river and neighboring Ardmore. The man behind Scribe and this project is our guest, Louis Messiah. He is the founder and executive director of Scribe Video Center, which is celebrating its 25th year. They produce grassroots films and videos. Precious Places, is made up of 41 short films of oral histories of Philadelphia's neighborhoods. His other films include W.E.B. Du Bois, a biography in four voices. He was a MacArthur Foundation fellow, and I should add, a former employee of WHYY, in fact, to produce the Move Commission hearings many, many years ago. And Louis, great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Marty, it's great to be here. Great to see you.
Nice to have you here. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Also, if you want to check out one of the Precious Places videos, you can go to our homepage at whyy.org, and you will see a portrait of a neighborhood at 58th and Locust Street in West Philadelphia. Louis, what was the genesis for this whole project?
Sure. I mean, sometimes when I work on a project, and actually this is a project that was produced by the makers, that is the members of 42 different community groups in Philadelphia. But anyway, sometimes to move things forward, usually there are a lot of different things that sort of point in that direction. One very big thing was we began this in 2002, which was beginning of a new century.
Indeed.
A new millennium. And Philadelphia had never had an oral history, and it really seemed like this would be a great moment and time to do it. Also, this was a time of tremendous development and changes in neighborhoods. City development with the Neighborhood Transformation Initiative, private developers, universities, the Philadelphia Housing Authority was bulldozing, you know, older buildings and building new buildings. So there's a lot of change, and also a lot of anxiety in some neighborhoods about what was going to happen. Were people going to be moved out? What was going to happen to tax rates? So it felt like this would be a very, very important time to document what our neighborhoods are and what people value in the places where they live, because in a lot of ways our sense of place, our sense of community has there are very physical things, there are buildings, there are streets, there are
parks,
landmarks,
or
that sort of define things, churches, right?
Well, and this, the idea though was to give residents cameras under, I guess, supervision and instruction from people from Scribe to
right.
allow them, I guess, to tell their own stories.
Absolutely. I mean, Scribe has had a long-term sort of collaborations with community groups in Philadelphia and the surrounding areas. And so the idea was to work with neighborhood and community groups to let them define, you know, what is a precious place in your community, in your neighborhood. So we found, sent out a solicitation, and we got a lot of responses back. And then the first year we chose, I think, 21 different groups. And each of those groups we paired with an independent filmmaker connected to Scribe. Philadelphia has a very, very strong independent film community. And we also paired each of these groups with a humanities scholar from one of the area colleges and universities, from Temple and U of Penn, from Haverford, from Cheney, from Rutgers. I mean, all the community
sure.
college, all the schools. And each of them, each of the groups sort of studied about oral history, studied about interview techniques, and with the filmmakers really learned about documentary production. But the actual work, the actual production work was done by the members of the community mm-hmm. organizations. They were the ones responsible for shooting and sound and lighting and most importantly, the story that was going to be told.
You know, what really struck me, and I watched a lot of these precious places, right. Portraits yesterday. This is not the story, frankly, that we've been talking a lot about on Radio Times about Philadelphia. We have focused on the poverty rate, the crime rate, the struggling schools, you know, corruption in government. Mm-hmm. But what I got from watching all these videos is people telling their own stories. It's a very different kind of story than you might hear, for instance, on the nightly news.
Right. And that is so interesting. Not that most of them or all of these are, you know, 100%, you know, feel-good stories. Some of them deal with very, very real issues that they define. Issues like eminent domain. What does it mean when the city or the county decides that, you know, we're going to destroy your block because we think we can find a developer that can bring more tax revenues to the city? But people defining their issues, community groups defining their issues, it's quite different than an outside filmmaker, sure. You know, commercial media or whoever defining the issue. So having some space for people to sort of share their voice, it's really important, and it also affects how we think about those neighborhoods. If those neighborhoods say that, yeah, this is what the value of this neighborhood is. This is the beauty of this neighborhood. It's quite different than an outsider not even seeing what the value is or just defining it by a problem.
Well, and just to underscore that, and I think it's true probably for most communities, but again, I think communities that have been described as, you know, poverty stricken mm-hmm. or having all the problems of urban poverty, outsiders don't see what's precious to the people that live there, whether it's the church or some local garden or even a cemetery. There's a lot of cemeteries, I thought, interesting in these various stories.
Right. Actually, we worked with two communities where the cemeteries are really prominent. One is the Fairhill Cemetery on Germantown Avenue, which is an old Quaker cemetery that has really important history in terms of actually the abolition movement. There are some very important abolitionists buried there. And also Mount Moriah Cemetery in Southwest Philadelphia, which has a very important Civil War history. These cemeteries had been neglected, both of them, and Fairhill actually had this extraordinary transformation which came about through a coalition of community members, Quakers who from Center City sort of saying, okay, this is land that, you know, that we should shepherd and mentor, and you know, sort of really pulling these forces together, were able to sort of transform the cemetery, which had become really a problem and an eyesore, and to a really beautiful space that where kids play and really is sort of a heart of the neighborhood.
Well, and the Mount Moriah Preservation Society, that looking again at the video, you can see, you know, Center City in the background, but this is a quiet, right. almost rural part of the city where people go to take care of their loved ones who are buried there. But I think also just to be where it feels like country.
Right, it feels like country. Mount Moriah still needs a lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, Mount Moriah, the neighbors who sort of surround Mount Moriah are still quite concerned and involved. And a lot of the Mount Moriah preservation people are not necessarily people who live in the neighborhood. They're people who have loved ones buried at Mount Moriah. But still, Mount Moriah definitely needs work in terms of becoming a more presentable, you know, place. I actually have a cousin that's buried at
Mount
Moriah.
Yeah. You knew that, or you discovered that?
No, I knew that. I knew that. Yeah, older cousin. Yeah, right.
The documentary also looks at a number of neighborhoods that are undergoing this, I guess, gentrification process, and many of the older people living there, you know, see the values of the houses going up, see people that moved in that weren't there when they lived there and were kids there 60 or 65 years ago, and it's, again, an interesting portrait of neighborhoods going through some kind of transformation and how the older folks feel about it.
Growing up in Philadelphia, my idea of South Philadelphia was anything south of South Street. So basically that area between Broad and the Schuylkill and South and whatever Christian was South Philadelphia, but now it is Center City.
Yes, exactly.
And for many, many years was the center of the African-American community. And now it is a very, very popular area and an area that has gone through incredible gentrification. The Odunde Group, sort of headed by Lois Fernandez, really looks at what does gentrification mean for residents that are there. Yes, people are happy to see values go up, but what does it mean when their children can no longer afford to live in that area? What does it mean when people become really concerned about taxes and the ability to maintain their home, and pay taxes? So, definitely there are. You know, people want things to get better. They want to see infrastructure improve, but they don't want to be moved out as a result of it.
I mean, they want what they value in the places that they've lived. But again, I guess there's always that little tension when a neighborhood is going through this kind of transformation.
And I think people also want everyone, new people and old people, to respect the history of that land, to realize that this is not just a house. There are deep memories. There are important memories attached to these streets, and to be able to share that. And if that kind of conversation can begin, I think people begin to understand each other a little bit better.
And it's interesting that you say, you know, families want their children to be able to live in the neighborhood. And I don't know if that's true of Philadelphia, but back before I worked on the radio, I spent a lot of time working in various neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And it was true. You'd have, you know, mom and dad here, their siblings around the corner, their children around the other corner. Right. And it was a very neighborhoody feeling. Now, some kids wanted to flee that because they didn't want to live under the gaze of their ancestors. But did you find that's true about Philadelphia?
And Philadelphia, well, certainly, and it's not the case for New York, is a place where people live, you know, the same family may live in that same neighborhood for many generations, four, five, six generations. And suddenly when there is change, when there's this increase in real estate values, that upsets this. The family is upset, and the family the notions of what the community is change radically, and people don't know what the future will bring.
We have a minute before our first break here, but you know, this is another way I think of looking at Philadelphia, and many are very excited that there are neighborhoods that are getting fixed up, people even in New York now want to live in Philadelphia because they see it as a desirable place to live, but this is another side of telling that story, which is there are people who live there a long time, and for them it's a different story. It's a different experience.
Yeah, I think it is so important for people to define what they value about where they live and to share that with whoever, so that people can see that, you know, even though you may not be able to see this history, let me tell it to you. And that's a lot of what we were trying to do with this whole project.
Well, tell you what, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Louis Messiah. He's the executive director, founder of Scribe Video Center. The center is celebrating its 25th year and has been producing grassroots films and videos. His latest project is Precious Places, and it's now airing on TV12 Sunday nights at 11:30. It's a series of 41 short films of the oral histories of Philadelphia's many neighborhoods. His other films include W.E.B. Du Bois, A Biography in Four Voices. He actually used to work here at WHYY, and he did produce the MOVE Commission hearings. And we do want to hear from our listeners, those of you living in neighborhoods, especially those undergoing some transformation. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Hallelujah to a Philadelphia tradition.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Hello, I'm Fred Child. Join us for Handel's Messiah, featuring the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Philadelphia Singers Chorale. Richard Hickox will conduct Handel's glorious oratorio, Messiah, from Philadelphia, from NPR.
Tuesday morning at 10 on WHYY.
It's that time of year again. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, it's our annual Christmas Spectacular. We'll talk about mistletoe, two great plants with Christmas in their name, and how to use lavender to celebrate the season, plus songs, stories, and more. That's the You Bet Your Garden Christmas Spectacular, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the darkest night of the year, we celebrate the turning of the season. Join the Paul Winter Consort for a fresh approach to one of public radio's most popular holiday traditions. I'm John Schaefer. Join us at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine for Solstice Live, Paul Winter's 27th annual Winter Solstice Concert from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about Precious Places. It's a project of Scribe Video. It airs Sunday nights on TV 12. And it's a series of very small portraits done by residents living in various communities in the city. They were given cameras to provide oral and video portraits of their communities. And taken together, they do provide a really rich and interesting picture of some of the ethnic and political and cultural diversity and richness of the city. And Louis Masai is our guest, the man behind Scribe, and joining us today on Radio Times to talk about what some of these video stories tell us about the city. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get John from Bucks County to join us. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. I grew up in the Bustleton section of Philadelphia in the far northeast. And, like, unlike a lot of the neighborhoods in the city, like, you know, a lot of neighbors are all rows or all twins or something. There's a mix of singles. You got split levels, you got ranches all over the place. And what happened the past few years is, you know, with the real estate boom, I'm also a realtor, like, property value shot up. You know,
sure.
The house my parents bought, they bought, you know, for under $100,000. And now it's worth, you know, well in excess of that. And I was wondering, you know, a lot of these specials on Philadelphia in general, they tend to gloss over the Northeast. I had a question for your guest if
sure.
They're going to be looking at Northeast Philadelphia in their show.
It's a good question. John, go ahead, Louis.
Sure. We actually worked with a couple of projects in Northeast Philadelphia. One with Tacony, the Tacony area, which actually has a very, very rich historical society and really know the history of the Diston Mills. Henry Diston was the big industrialist that sort of really created this planned community of Tacony, as well as with Oxford Circle. We actually are going to continue Precious Places in 2008 and really are looking for those areas of the city that we don't have the representation that mm-hmm. we would like. And certainly the Northeast is one. Olney is a very important area, as well as Southwest Philadelphia. But certainly, you know, Northeast it's a huge part of the city, and it's certainly part of the vision of a citywide oral history.
And John, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And I wonder, Louis, whether once you get to know a neighborhood, you realize that it's not just one neighborhood, that there are all sorts of interesting groups within that
absolutely,
neighborhood.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are so many neighborhoods. I mean, 41, we actually made 42, but we did like a pilot for the 42nd one or whatever. 41 is, they're probably 200, 300. I don't even know how many neighborhoods
sure.
in Philadelphia.
Sure.
And so, and within each neighborhood, there are, you know, different sides of the neighborhood. So, all stories are quite complex in reality.
This is a personal question to you, but you grew up in North Philadelphia.
I grew up in North Philadelphia.
Which part of Philadelphia was that?
What
is that called today?
I don't even know. I mean, I live near Temple. I get Templetown, unfortunately, is what they're
is
calling
right?
it now. But North Philadelphia, yeah.
And I should add that you live in the house where you grew up.
Yeah, you know, I do. I mean, I sort of.
Are you grimacing while you're saying that?
I'm definitely grimacing. You know, like filmmakers need to keep their rent low, and so I figured, okay, my parents are deceased, and so I said, hey, you know, why not? So
grew up in the family home.
Right, right.
But you were talking about Precious Places and how, you know, certain buildings have certain meaning mm-hmm. and memories for people. But I'm thinking about growing up, I mean, living in the house as an adult where you grew up, it's got to be filled with all those memories and history.
There have been times when I have been immobilized, you know, by, you know, memory and depth and, you know, trying to throw away a sofa, that, a no-good sofa, but there's just so many, you know, it's hard to like, ah, well, my mother loved that sofa. How can I throw it out now? But
feeling disloyal,
disloyal, yeah. But you know, if you just take it a little piece by a time, at a time, you can sort of, you know, change things.
There's a really interesting piece about in North Philadelphia. It's a cooperative at 8th and Fairmount, and this is a Friends...
The Friends Neighborhood Guild. Yeah. Very important enterprise, really, that sort of began as an interracial housing idea, and that's still alive and thriving. Actually, Felicia Coward is the executive director, and it was a planned community that began that sort of to deal with what was at that time pretty strict segregation. You know, Philadelphia was not. I mean, there were areas that where you might have some mixture, but basically neighborhoods were quite segregated in Philadelphia. And I think now also
still are pretty
segregated. Yeah,
but the idea was that you could bring, I guess, in this case, what, blacks and whites, and perhaps even other groups together,
and
to
Latinos.
Live together.
It's interesting. I actually learned this through another Scribe project. We have something called the Documentary History Project for Youth, and which was looking at the history of the settlement houses. And apparently, there was a strong Latino community within the Friends Neighborhood Guild. So the local Young Lords chapter has its roots at the Friends Neighborhood Guild. So yes, it was definitely a mixed ethnic community.
But the idea that diverse racial groups could live together as neighbors.
And live together, build together, support each other, right.
And did it work, or is it working?
It worked. I mean, it's not so interracial now. It's mainly African American, but it was really for 30, 40 years of its early existence, yeah.
There's one man in that piece who talks, he actually is a white man, and he talks saying all the sort of good feelings that he had, but he said when there was gunfire,
right.
He thought, I got to get out of here.
Yeah. He was able to go, and he left, but he's somebody who still is committed, you know, to the guild.
And I wonder, even doing, and I realize that these projects grew up and were created by the communities themselves, whether you do get a sense of the kind of racial politics in the city. As you said, a very segregated city, then a pretty segregated city. Now, do you get a sense of how the races understand each other or view each other?
I'm not so sure. I don't know that. I mean, I definitely... And it's not just race; it's also the class differences. You know, neighborhoods sort of segregate by class as well. I think what unites things is an extraordinary pride that people have when they live in a place, and wanting to make sure that if new people move in, that they understand why people are proud of their neighborhoods. But it's interesting, looking at the issue of eminent domain, in the first year we worked with the Community Leadership Institute, which was headed by Rosemary Kubas, who unfortunately died, I think, about a year ago. And she was a real crusader for neighbors to sort of fight for their neighborhoods and prevent them from being bulldozed for development that was not in the benefit of the community. But she was able to form very important coalitions with Cramer Hill, which is an area in Camden, which also was dealing with eminent domain, as well as Ardmore, which,
yes,
you know, Ardmore in on the main line, which is also dealing with another kind of eminent domain. So really uniting around the issue of, you know, we who live in this neighborhood have some right to determine what's going to happen. So there was this cross between, you know, a variety of different classes and ethnicities.
And this goes back a couple of years, so the beginning of the first street administration, the idea of the Neighborhood Transformation Initiative, NTI, was to take blighted neighborhoods, I guess plow them under in certain cases, and create better housing for people.
Well, but I actually think it was more complex than that. And certainly there were people within the NTI, program that really understood that if we just bulldoze, we're going to lose very important things. There was a woman, the head of the City Planning Commission, Maxine Griffith, actually was a champion of this project. One of the things she realized is if before the wrecking ball goes in, if we just send in architectural historians, the architectural historian is going to say, well, that's a wonderful Federalist era building, or that's a wonderful, you know, Victorian something or another. But there's got to be some way that communities can say, hey, this old storefront has deep memories, deep importance to us, and it may not be much in terms of the architectural historians, but this is where a rally happened to protest, you know, the segregation of Girard College. So we're not going to destroy this building in Francisville because of that history. So and it was really through that conversation that we sort of did the prototypes in Francisville for Precious Places. So there, I think there was an awareness that it wasn't just about tearing things down, but sometimes, you know, there's a lot of money in land, and so there's a lot of forces that, you know, you have to sort of harness to make sure that things don't go awry.
And Francisville is in that area of Girard College.
Yeah, Francisville is the area bounded by Fairmount and Girard, Corinthian. I think it goes all the way to Broad, but it's a pretty big area. Yeah.
And in that is the famous or infamous Girard College.
Girard College is on the other side of Girard Avenue, and now, of course, is a completely different institution.
Indeed.
You know, it's coeducational, predominantly students of color. Yeah.
That's Louis Messiah, our guest today on Radio Times. He's executive director, founder of Scribe Video, which is celebrating its 25th year, producing grassroots films and videos. And Scribe's latest project is called Precious Places. It airs now on TV12, Sunday nights at 11:30. And it's a series of 41 short films of oral histories of Philadelphia's many neighborhoods. And we are talking about some of the interesting transformations in neighborhoods and the relationship between some of the old-timers and newcomers, and how that history gets translated from one generation to another, or one neighbor to another. Louis's other films include W.E.B. Du Bois, A Biography in Four Voices. He did actually produce the Move Commission hearings at WHYY when he was an employee here, and he's also one of those MacArthur genius fellows, and he joins us this morning on Radio Times. Do give us a call if you have any questions or comments, or even stories about a neighborhood that you're living in the city that's undergoing a transformation. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You know, I'm thinking of NTI and some of these neighborhoods that were, I guess, targeted by NTI. Mm-hmm. Looking at some of these videos and hearing some of these stories, did these people prevail? I mean, were they able to stop those bulldozers, so to speak?
Some were, some weren't. But actually, I just wanted to add one thing.
Go ahead.
These are... Although I am the artistic director of this, and I'm the executive director of Scribe, these are not my films. These films were created by the 41 community groups that worked and shot and, you know, edited these works. I mean, I claim them as my children, but they really are. You know, it's a lot of work. You know, of I could probably maybe 200 people and more than 200 people in total sort of working on these. But in terms of did they prevail, some of them did. I mean, unfortunately, the area of for the Community Leadership Institute that they were working on, Bodine Street, which is near American Street, sort of in sort of the eastern part of North Philadelphia, Kensington, that area was bulldozed. And these were houses that were occupied, people were living in, and they were bulldozed for some imagine development. You can drive by there now, and
there's nothing there.
Just flat land. But Kramer Hill, which is in Camden, succeeded, or seems to have succeeded for the time being. And Ardmore seems to have succeeded. There were shops along Lancaster Avenue that were slated for takeover through eminent domain, but they have managed to sort of stop that process. Or I don't know if it's how long it is, but it seems like they've been able to organize. And certainly Rosemary Kubas Community Leadership Institute and the process of making that videotape really became a tool that these other groups were able to share. In some ways, you know, I'm as proud of the works from Philadelphia as I am the works that came out of Camden. We were able to work with I think, 6 or 7 different neighborhoods in Camden, and it really is like the best part of documentary filmmaking, that is this kind of work, because it gives you permission to visit neighborhoods.
Knock on people's doors,
Knock on people's doors, you know, and you're there really working with them, you're an invited guest. So it's just like a joy to be able to travel around.
And just, I do want to get back to our callers, but sure. Just picking on something you said earlier, you said Philadelphia is really a rich place for independent filmmakers.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's work to be done. There's community, I guess, as well.
Right, right. Yeah, and there, I guess there are a lot of reasons. One is proximity to New York.
Yes.
One is, I'd say certainly Temple University has been really important. Scribe, I think, has been very important in sort of nurturing independent filmmakers. And people tend to work fairly collaboratively. It's not quite as maybe cutthroat as other places. And so we people find a way to work together, which has really been a strength of a project like this.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I've heard actors also say that there is this collaborative atmosphere in Philadelphia, that actors oftentimes will work together and support each other, and thereby create this community that helps nurture what they love to do.
Great. Yeah, yeah.
Let me get to Ken from Wayne to join us. Ken, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes. Marty, I'm a member of Save Aardmore Coalition and was present when Scribe Video made their presentation of the film made specifically about Aardmore and Kramer Hill, and I believe another video.
Mm-hmm.
And present were the local politicians that were running, I guess I think it was an election cycle at the time. And it seemed like that video and the other videos brought the non-economic benefits of preserving these neighborhoods home to the politicians. And I think that was part of the reason that we were successful in Aardmore and in preventing eminent domain from changing the historical block.
Well, that's interesting, great, Ken. Great. And do you think it was because of the kind of stories that go along with preservation?
Exactly. The I think the elected representatives have been presented with all the economic data in behalf of going ahead with eminent domain, but hadn't really been exposed to the human effect. And I think the Scribe Video productions that were displayed that night really brought it home, and I think it was a key component to the success in Aardmore.
Go ahead, Lily.
Great. You know, thanks so much. I mean, one of the things that we talk about when people make work at Scribe is this whole idea of utility. That is, you're trying to make a film that tells an interesting story. You want it technically to be proficient. You want people to be moved by it. But you also want something that's useful. And I am very proud of the Aardmore group and all of the groups that were able to use the those videotapes as ways to further their causes or to further a vision. And sometimes just, you know, sharing that vision can sort of help you know, achieve a particular end.
But it sounds like there is a point of view. I mean, that there is point of view in this case about preserving what was in Aardmore.
There's a perspective, absolutely, yes.
And Ken, just a quick update. How were things in Aardmore?
Well, there's several other projects planned, but at this point in time, they do not involve eminent domain, and therefore will probably proceed along much more friendly lines, and not result in individuals losing their businesses and properties.
Well, great. I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ken. And you can call as well. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Louis Messiah today on the show about a project done by Scribe Video, and it's called Precious Places, and it's a series of portraits of many of the diverse and interesting communities here in Philadelphia. In fact, if you want to check one out, go to the WHYY homepage at whyy.org, and you can learn about a garden at 58th and Locust Streets in West Philadelphia. You can also give us a call here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guests and take some more phone calls as well. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
For millions of families throughout the world, the live Christmas Eve broadcast of a festival of 9 lessons and carols heralds the beginning of the holiday. Hear the Christmas story told in words and music by the world-famous choir of King's College. I'm Michael Barone. Do join us for a festival of nine lessons and carols live in Cambridge, England, from American Public Media.
Monday morning at 10 o'clock on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
It seemed like a good idea.
A secret Santa leaves a phone number to make sure some needy kids get their gifts.
Thank you for the presents you gave me. I love you.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice.
But then, the calls kept coming.
Can I have a few presents because my mom is broke? Santa! Santa!
How to ring up a holiday headache.
Mom, Santa!
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Political dynasties, the Bushes, maybe the Clintons. Should family members be barred from following each other into office? Also, a mother's Christmas gift to her daughter, a memoir of her life as a political refugee. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Louis Messiah is our guest, a founder, executive director of Scribe Video Center, and we're talking about the latest project of Scribe called Precious Places, looking at some of the interesting oral histories from Philadelphia's many neighborhoods. And we've got just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Bob from Northeast Philadelphia joining us. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm intrigued with your guest, and it's a very positive perspective he's, you know,
good.
Projecting. I'm wondering, or have been for years, about similar research being done on precious people from upwards of 100 different countries represented in neighborhoods in Philadelphia as an asset, a phenomenal resource to our departments of education.
I guess the idea that we've got people from all over the world, you're saying, living in neighborhoods in Philadelphia?
Yeah, well, they have specific regions and places that they tend to, you know, they're like ghettos. You might have Italian, French, German, Polish, I mean, on and on.
Russian,
Chinese,
and Ugandan, and the like.
I mean, it's like the real people coming from there to the United States with a wonderful appreciation of what we have and what they left behind, treasuring the best of their cultures.
Well, Bob, let me toss your point to Louis Messiah. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things with Precious Places is realizing that certainly, you know, ethnicity is part of the wealth of Philadelphia, and also looking at various ethnic histories. I mean, one of the joys of the project, you know, there are many, many joys. I mean, I should say there were 42 joys of working on the project, but one was working with the Filipino American National Historical Society. I did not know that St. Augustine's Church, which is very close to WHYY, it's at 4th and Race, I guess. I didn't know that that was the center of the Filipino American community.
I didn't either.
And that it's this landmark. And also not knowing the long, long history going back to the early 20th century in terms of Filipino American influence in Philadelphia and based in Chinatown at that point. So just learning about that and learning how that community revitalized that church. And it's interesting, that church has a history in terms of, has a long history in terms of immigrant communities. It was actually burned down as during the Know Nothing riots. The Know Nothing riots were riots by nativists against mainly Irish Americans in the early, you know, mid-19th century, in the mid-1800s. And I think St. Augustine and St. Michael's, which is at on Jefferson and Second, were both burned down.
Wow.
But now, again, there's a new immigrant population that has taken this church and sort of brought great, great life and energy to it.
And what you see, and Bob, thanks for the call, what you see are I mean, there's so many houses of worship
right,
in the city,
right, right.
Not surprisingly, but
right.
The sort of central role that so many churches and other houses of worship played in
right.
Various small communities.
Absolutely. I mean, churches... churches and cemeteries are big, precious places. They really are, you know.
Let me get Wendy from Doylestown to join us. Hi, Wendy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi there. You know, I love your show.
Thank you.
My husband was one of the original owners in a neighborhood at a near temple called Yorktown, and I wondered if that was part of your project.
Absolutely. We actually did a wonderful...
Sounds like your neighborhood, Louis.
Yeah, well, it's kind of my neighborhood. It's the other side of Broad. So, but yeah, Yorktown did a wonderful piece, really looking at the history of Yorktown, which was one of the very first successful urban housing ventures. Dr. Gray, actually Congressman Dr. William Gray, the congressman's father, was a real prime mover in that. And there was a banker, I guess his name, I think his name was Denny, that sort of decided, okay, what rather than building rental housing, what if we made we created affordable housing in the city proper? So in the 1960s, they created this wonderful community of affordable houses that people bought, and it's still a very strong, vibrant community. Right now, there is some, it's not tension, but they really have to figure out the relationship with Temple, because Temple is looking for, Temple students are looking for places to live, which means, you know, what does it mean when a house that was meant for a single family is being cut up into seven apartments,
right,
and then you have, you know, so they have, they're working that through, but it's still a very vibrant and healthy community.
Oh, Wendy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I think just all that just underscores that cities are, I mean, they're alive and changing.
Absolutely.
I mean, nothing is static, right, in a city.
And you can't fight change just for fighting change, but you do want to be able to control change in a way that is healthy and that sort of, you know, makes it possible for people to live, you know.
Let me get to Ed from Montgomeryville to join us. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Your program is very interesting today.
Good. Thank you.
I'm 69 and a half, be 70 in July,
okay,
and I grew up in the Winfield area, which was ethnically 99% Jewish. And I wondered if he had covered the history of that era in this documentary.
And that era, I guess, when it changed from 99% Jewish?
Well, what happened was that it gradually changed and the people moved out and it became an African-American neighborhood.
Yes, it did.
I was talking earlier with actually somebody who works with you about Winfield and Overbrook Park, two really wonderful areas that were predominantly Jewish and have now sort of change. Winfield is mainly African-American. Overbrook Park, I think, has a variety of different folks that are living there. Winfield, too, at this point. And we actually began a project, and we don't always talk about our failures, but that was actually a project that the group sort of fell apart.
Oh, is that right?
They actually shot, but didn't edit. But we would love to work with a group, and we would love for the group to finish their piece. But, yeah, those histories of those communities are quite interesting, quite important.
Ed, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Tim from Mayfair to join us. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I would like to make two comments. First, I think the MacArthur Foundation was correct. And second, there's a large group of people in Burholm and Fox Chase that are fighting to preserve Burholm Park, which is one of our precious places.
Mm.
And we're fighting against the Cancer Center. We're fighting against City Hall. We're fighting against the City Council that thinks that it's either or, that you have to expand the Cancer Center or save the park. And this is intellectually dishonest, because we can expand the Cancer Center in many other locations and continue to save the park, which has historic designation for the grounds and the mansion.
Well, and Tim, I know there is a growing, I guess, controversy in your neighborhood over Fox Chase and Burholm Park. Louis, anything you want to add to that?
No, I really appreciate your call, Tim, and it also shows if Burholm Park, you know, was able to sort of create a message and sort of explain the importance, I think a lot of people might change sides. I mean, I didn't know what the struggle was about in Fox Chase. I did know that there was a resolution that was supposed to be presented, but it's great to hear a resident explain what it's about, as opposed to just hearing representatives from Fox Chase or city government. Not to say that either of those two entities shouldn't have a perspective, and expansion of Fox Chase may not is not a good thing. But it is really important to hear what neighbors have to say about the whole issue.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And we do have some open lines if you want to give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. I wonder, though, is that the philosophy then of Scribe, which is to sort of empower people who may not have a natural microphone or access to the halls of power, so to speak?
I actually think it's more basic than that. I think that we can't function as a democracy, and I'm just talking about the city or the region. We're making decisions about each other based on mass media, based on media that may not necessarily have the best interests of that community. Not to say that they're trying to do something harmful, but they may not have the best interests of that community. So in order for us to make intelligent decisions, let's say, should I support Fox Chase expansion? It's important for people in that community to say, this is our perspective. So then we can then make a judgment. Or if all you hear about a certain neighborhood is violence, and then you'll think, well, the only answer for that community is much, much, much more money for police, as opposed to saying maybe the community is talking about recreation centers and restoring a park, and maybe that's a better way to spend the money. So it does become important for us to function, to make judgments about each other, for communities to have some way of sharing their, their situation with a broad public.
And was that the sort of nub of the idea for the creation of Scribe, which is to sort of build technology in a way around idea?
Yes, and we work with community groups. We do a lot of work with individual artists. We work with people who have personal visions, artistic visions that may not necessarily have a social or political, clear slant or whatever. We work with mid-level artists, who want to learn more about new technologies, whether it's Pro Tools or Final Cut Pro, or these softwares that people use in media production. But it is about allowing emerging artists, be they members of community groups or be they individual artists, to really have the tools and the language to share with the public.
And winning that MacArthur Award, did that help sort of free you up to? We're on the radio here, but Louis, you just gave me this look like, oh no.
Well, in some ways, I don't want to look any gift horses in the mouth, and it was very much appreciated and came at a time when I really could use it. But in some ways, maybe my getting it and my reaction to it may have said that this is not a genius award, because what I ended up doing was Scribe doesn't really have a whole lot of money, but so therefore it allowed me to work at Scribe as an arts administrator as opposed to making films.
Gotcha.
Because I actually was making money by making films. So free me up, I wouldn't quite put it that way, but it did allow me to put a lot of time and energy into building the organization.
But that's, I guess, the frustration of some artists, which is you have something you want to nurture and develop, which means you sit in an office and talk on the phone all day, you go out with your camera and do your work.
And Scribe is a very collaborative project. Right. I mean, we have a strong board. I have wonderful colleagues that I work with there. People like Jamis Wells and Napoleon Wanissa were very, very important in terms of realizing the Precious Places project.
Let me get Jimmy from Gap, Pennsylvania, to join us. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yes. Hi there. Thank you for all your work. I was at Philadelphia Film Festival last year. Mm-hmm. I think it was a Scribe film about cancer, a group of films. But at any rate, I was interested in Camden as a topic, the 1969 African-American riots, or whatever you want to call them. And I was in Camden, and I saw the beautiful old library with a tree growing out where the roof has fallen in. There's a big tree growing out of it. Mm. I just wondered about the timeline. I think that would make a neat documentary about from the day before the riots and the timeline up till now.
Well, Jimmy, let me give Louis a chance to respond to your call.
And the Scribe response is, if this is your idea, we
go
can
for
help
it,
you. You know, we can tell you how to write a script. We can help you learn how to use a camera, help you edit. I mean, this is your story. This is something that you are, this is your, something you're connected to, and you are going to be the best person to tell that story. Making documentaries is a language, and once you have that language, you can share it with lots and lots of people.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. An interesting dodge on your part, but I think there's also, you're saying something important, and so many people now have, you know, video mm-hmm. phones, and cameras are so much a part of our life now.
Right.
It's just a matter of, what, thinking like a documentarian in a way, or?
I'm serious about the language. It's a basic way for an individual to communicate with a broader public. It's worth taking the few months to sort of gain a basic proficiency right. with learning how to tell a story through documentary.
How'd you get interested in making films?
I guess through the storytelling potential. I had been a science writer, and I wanted to learn much more about production. So I said, well, okay, let me go and study some. So I actually went to graduate school and studied about documentary filmmaking. Hmm. Sort of got moved from science a little bit and became very interested in sort of social documentaries. So really the storytelling possibilities, the narrative possibilities of documentary.
You were part of Eyes on the Prize, too.
Right? Yeah, right. I worked on two films on Eyes on the Prize, which I'm very happy to say are going to be rebroadcast in 2008. I worked on the second series of Eyes on the Prize. And that was a wonderful learning experience. I mean, I actually had worked at HYY first, and I love all the folks here, but I realize I was not a great director.
Is that right?
I think I was a great storyteller, but I mean, there were like wonderful folks here. There was a guy named Sterling Scott who was just a salt of the earth, just wonderful human being, and John McElhenney, and just really great folks that were here. And they really
helped
me.
They saved you?
Oh, they saved me. They definitely saved me, yeah.
So you're really, I mean, you think of yourself as a storyteller?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what you do.
History, and I'm particularly interested in history, yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us. I congratulate you as well, and a great pleasure to have you with us.
Marty, it's always wonderful to see you. It's always wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Louis Messiah, our guest. We've been talking about Precious Places, a project of Scribe Video Center that he founded and now is executive producer of. And you can check out these videos Sunday nights on TV 12 at 11:30. We've also put one on our webpage at whyy.org. You can go there and check it out. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum, the producers of the program. Sarah Edelman helping us out this week, and Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of the show. We're off for the next couple of days. We do hope that you have a very safe and happy holidays. We'll be back live on Wednesday. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And do see whether
support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.